Chapter 51. Be smart, Donis. No running, Coach says. Following Bobby Lafleur's directions feels normal, muscle memory from the before. Coach Bobby always listens to public radio. All those rides home after practice, returning from away games in the middle of the night. He looked out for me, defended me when other high school coaches said no girls should be on a guy's varsity team. Shut up and treat that player like any other. Once we get you set up outside Rayco, middle of nowhere, you'll do everything we say. Forget about your boyfriend. He's done. Coach says with a terrifying calmness. No, Jamie isn't dead. Mike wouldn't. I'm no longer able to assess what people are or are not capable of. Coach continues, you'll cook the best meth and your mom stays alive. Jamie is no longer the incentive. They'll hurt her. I should have called mom when I had Sini's phone. I could have warned her. If they get me to their remote meth lab, I'll never see mom or Jamie again. They'll keep threatening people I love to keep me in line. Maybe Auntie and the twins next, one by one. Coach pulls over at the golf course, near an equipment garage. My brother emerges from it and sprints to the car. In one blink, Levi is in the back seat directly behind me. He's breathing hard as he reaches around the headrest of my seat to place his hand on my left shoulder. The one he knows always hurts. The one with a bite-shaped bruise. My brother doesn't do anything but rest his hand there. It is a threat and a betrayal. A low keening comes from deep inside my chest. Coach shrugs. Too bad, so sad. As if I've complained about a crap call on the ice. We can't control the bad calls, Fontaine. But what can we control? I'd answer, I can control how I react, move on, focus on the next play. As Coach gets back on the road, we hear sirens in the distance. Ron and his law enforcement colleagues arriving at last? Did my tracker bring them, or are they responding to the ferry captain, who must have reported an assault on an elder by the Soup's team captain? Levi turns to look behind us. I only know because his hand pulls away from its resting spot on my shoulder. Coach tilts his head slightly to look in the rearview mirror. I'm the only one with my eyes ahead, focused on the next play, which is why I see the tribal cop car approaching from the opposite direction. A massive figure fills the driver's side. I keep mixing up the bad guys and the good guys. With lightning speed, I jerk the steering wheel toward me. We instantly leave the road, hitting a tree at an angle with enough force to spin the back end of the car into another tree. The next thing I know, my face hurts. I piece together what happened. I raised my arms instinctively as we left the road. The front airbag deployed with enough force that I punched myself in the face with my forearms. Something is dripping over my lips. I taste tangy copper pennies and salt. My nose is bleeding. Both shoulders hurt like hell. The seatbelt is tight against my chest. It's only now that I realize how hard it is to breathe. When I manage to undo the seatbelt, my lungs expand. My vision comes back. I was on the verge of passing out. Coach Bobby's door is open. I crawl over the gear shift and his seat to tumble onto the ground. I get away from the car as quickly as possible because the possibility of it exploding from leaking fuel is a rational fear. A deep voice shouts behind me, "Put your hands on your head and drop to your knees." I do as TJ orders, landing hard. When I try raising my hands like on television shows, I gasp at the searing pain in both shoulders. My stomach hurts when I twist to look back at him. TJ's gun is aimed at Coach Bobby, who is frozen exactly like me on the other side of the road. TJ's partner reaches Bobby in a few quick strides. Once Bobby's arms are secured with handcuffs, TJ runs past me as if I'm invisible. Wait, did I die? I watch TJ aim at something along the side of the road. I don't remember us hitting a deer. Standing slowly, I announce my movements so I don't spook TJ or his partner. I'm walking over to you. My arms are raised, but my left shoulder can't go any higher. I don't have any weapons on me. TJ gulps when he looks at my face. He returns his gun to its holster on the black leather belt with all his cop gadgets. "Paramedics are on their way," he says in his normal voice. "Wait, you know I'm not part of Levi's meth ring?"
"Yes, I know now,"
TJ says, looking at the deer in the grass. He kneels down to help it. It's not a deer. I nearly collapse in shock. Levi is crumpled on his side looking up at us. His leg is bent at an odd angle.
"You and the undercover agent were reported missing and in danger. We know about the FBI investigation. Bobby LaFleur is news to us, but maybe not to the FBI.
TJ sounds ticked off. "They aren't telling us everything."
"Help me, Donis," Levi says. "Tell TJ the truth. Coach forced us to be in his business."
I step back in disbelief.
"I was trying to help you escape," he says.
One more step away from the lies.
"Stay with me, Donis. Kneel over me like you did when we were little. When you protected me until the ambulance came," he pleads.
It's not that moment I recall, but the one where his hand rested on my shoulder in the car. "I love you, Levi," I say. Levi brightens with hope. "Enough to do this." I turn to TJ. "Coach Bobby, Levi, Mike, Stormy, and Dana Firekeeper are part of the meth operations. Maybe Grant Edwards too, I'm not sure. At least one of them was involved in my Uncle David's death, and I think they have info about Heather Noden and Robin Bailey. Dana drugged and kidnapped me. Levi and Mike tasered and drugged Jamie and...
Jamie.
I need to go back for Jamie."
"You need medical attention," TJ says.
"He needs to know I didn't abandon him, John." It's been almost 3 years since I called him that. Our middle names whispered to each other. TJ hesitates, then speaks into his walkie-talkie to alert all LEOs that I'm headed to the ferry. As I take off, my brother shouts after me.
"I love you! I'm sorry! I love you! I'm sorry! I love you! I'm sorry!"
His voice gets smaller with each repetition until it's no longer in the air. The ferry hasn't left the mainland. The loading ramp is still extended like a drawbridge. I run past an ambulance. Sini pushes away an oxygen mask. Minnie pats her arm. A line of cop cars waits to board the ferry. An officer drives Levi's res truck down the ramp. Ron sprints toward me, but I keep running until I'm on the ferry deck. Johnsy pats the hood of his very good pony, and the door of the tomato-red Mustang is still ajar. I shout over my shoulder at Minnie that I need to borrow her car.
"Me gwitch, me gwitch, me gwitch,"
I add. For helping Sini, for slowing Levi down, for safe harbor. I turn her car around into the spot where Levi's truck was just a moment ago. I'm facing the back drawbridge, which will become the front ramp once we reach Sugar Island. Rolling down my window, I shout at the deckhand for us to go. Instead, he waits for John C. to exit and the ferry to fill with law enforcement vehicles. Ron catches up to the car.
"Donis, let me drive," he offers.
I don't budge. He sighs and gets in the passenger side.
"You're hurt," he says calmly.
"Jamie was still alive when I left the trailer." My voice is all cracks and bumps. The blast of the ferry horn makes me cry out in joy or pain or both. I tell Ron everything as we cross the St. Mary's River. The story spews forth like vomit. There's no time to sequence my thoughts. It feels like 5 hours later instead of 5 minutes when the reverse engine thrusters signal our arrival. The deckhand tosses the thick rope around the dock pilings before pressing the button for the hydraulic ramp. My patience lasts until the ramp is halfway down. I shift the Mustang into gear and am airborne for an instant before Minnie's tires burn rubber on Sugar Island. People always tease Minnie about driving 10 miles under the speed limit. My foot is heavy on the pedal. The Mustang roars as if to say, "Yes, yes, finally, yes." I pass a line of cars waiting to board the ferry. Ron breaks into my recap to ask about the location.
"We've got the Coast Guard headed to Lake George. Is it on the northeast or southeast shoreline, or more toward the midpoint?
I shout the east-west road I remember from the way out of the woods. Ron, it's an overhang in the Black Rocks. It looks narrow, but it angles back. It's wide enough for someone to float a trailer on a barge and wedge it in. It's why Jamie's GPS signal couldn't reach you. He had me wear it around my ankle. A voice on the other end of the device confirms the Coast Guard is on its way. It isn't until we are flying across the field that I see the cop cars behind us. Not right on our tail, but still keeping up. They must have been behind me this entire time. Lights flashing and sirens blaring. I just hadn't noticed until now. Strange how the mind can tune things out. I pass the stone shaped like a mini Medusa swan and swerve around the fallen birch tree. The road narrows until it's a winding trail. I follow the breadcrumbs of tire tracks that zigzag through the maple trees until we reach the pine forest. I park in the exact spot where the res truck was. I don't waste time shutting off the engine or closing the door. Ron keeps up with me as we hopscotch the rocks to cross the creek. When we run through the cave tunnel, I get a stitch in my side that takes my breath away. I power through as we run along the shoreline. Ron's in decent shape for an older guy. We round the sharp corner where the trailer is nestled in the crook of Black Rocks.
"Don't kill him! We're here! It's all over!"
I yell, arms reaching for the door.
"I came back for you, Jamie. I didn't abandon you."
I yank it open and rush inside. My legs go rubbery at what I see. I should not have announced our arrival. Their backs are to me, Stormy standing and Jamie kneeling in front of the bed. I scream as Stormy brings an axe down on Jamie's ankle with one powerful heave.